Well, it's been a very long and rich 2.5 days, and in, I think, a kind of British fashion, since I'm new to this country, everything new I say is British. We have not really defined terms ahead of time. Our understanding has grown organically out of our deliberations over the last couple of days. We've been talking on the one hand about boycotts, the history of boycotts, but also about the BDS movement of our own era, which calls not only for boycott, but also divestment and sanctions. So what I see is BDS is a more expansive form of social protest than many of the boycott movements we've been discussing. And in my remarks, I'd like to try to relate boycotts in history to the DNS in the triptych, but also tie BDS in with its historical predecessors. It's probably a tall order for 15 minutes, but I'll do what I can. First, retroactively, what have we meant when we've talked about a boycott? Perhaps to define it as an attempt to thwart exchange, economic or cultural or academic, a form of intentional social closure, a boycott movement arising within civil society and therefore a product of modernity and modern subjectivity, given its inherent claim of political empowerment upon those who engage in the boycott movement. It is no more related to pre-modern shunning than the modern revolution is akin to a bread riot. Boycott movements of the last 4 decades have also been a product of a massive technological transformation that has enabled rapid global communication, also of a certain level of affluence and consumerism, to get back to themes we talked about earlier on, as one can live for prolonged periods without California grapes or without California lettuce. There are other things one can buy in a supermarket in Los Angeles. One can live without Nestle chocolate. One can even live without a SodaStream carbonation machine. These are these little carbonation machines that were manufactured in the West Bank. No, actually in the Otter Road Industrial Zone, I believe. Someone told me that they've changed the production facility to China, so, in order to avoid the boycott. Now, let's talk a bit about the relationship between boycotts and sanctions, in that boycotts emanate from civil society, but sanctions come from governments. And if so, why are some actions by one state against another called boycotts? For example, and we didn't talk about this except by absence, the Arab, quote, boycott of Israel has implied non-recognition. Using the term boycott suggests non-recognition, whereas a sanction implies a stricture against a member of the international community. So you can't have a sanction against a state that you don't recognize. The US boycott of the 1980 Moscow Olympics was called this because the act was a refusal to engage in a form of exchange. It was not one government's punitive measure against another. The Nazi alleged boycott, which of course, as we heard so eloquently yesterday, was not a boycott, was directed against a group of German citizens, not another state. Yet the term boycott conveyed victimhood and a blending of state and society, the party representing, of course, the instantiation of the Volksgemeinschaft. Sanctions seek to limit a country's access to global finance and markets. They prohibit the sale of certain goods, whereas boycotts aim at purchase. Boycotts constitute mobilization of groups and not mere expressions of individual choice, and they can easily move from a call to purchase, not to purchase goods or services provided by members of one or more collectives, to attempts to convince or coerce wholesalers and distributors not to make goods available in the first place. Now, economic nationalism can justify boycotts. Gideon, you and I were talking about this yesterday. That economic nationalism can justify boycotts, but there is a conceptual and linguistic distinction between kauft nur bei and kauft nicht bei, only buy and do not buy, in that the only buy is directed against an abstract other and not a specific target. Divestment now, as we relate it to this notion of economic nationalism, the boycott, and sanctions, divestment, I would think, is conceptually an extension of boycott in that you have party X prevailing upon party Y, here a legal personage, to to withhold capital from party Z. Again, withdrawal, closure, and denial. So in all these cases, I think boycott and divestment have much in common. Sanctions are somewhat different, although obviously there is a connection. Now, I'm not going to talk about this question of the clarity of the goal, the end seal of the boycott movement. I think Jeremy just discussed it very eloquently. But I am concerned about the non-hierarchical quality that we heard extolled so rhapsodically earlier today does raise the question not only of where the boycott can end, but also what is being asked of the boycotted party, which is a very practical question if the boycotted party is considering seriously whether or not to heed the boycott movement. One has to know what's being asked and whether or not it is feasible. Now, several papers have suggested, to the point where it's really an orthodoxy of this conference, that historically boycotts have not had their desired economic effects, and that it's virtually impossible to boycott involvement. It's very much impossible to cut off every possible involvement of a boycotted collective in the production change, in the production chain. Nonetheless, we've heard boycotts can have a galvanizing effect upon a political movement, and we've heard something similar about sanctions. However, sanctions can also enhance feelings of encirclement and tensions between parties. So are boycotts and sanctions, and this is a question we've raised, but I don't think we've really answered it at all definitively, are boycotts and sanctions primarily ameliorative, or are they in fact punitive? Are they designed not to affect behavioral change, but rather to express outrage, or to provide individuals a sense of empowerment? When are boycotts performative rather than pragmatic? If their goal is solely to affect change, for example, is the BDS movement, especially in its horizontalist form, truly the best way to go about doing it? A critique we heard, I think a very intelligent critique we heard earlier today. Several papers dealt with the what about factor, why Israel and not, why X and not Y. And they address this question with depth and substance. And for this, I must say, I'm extraordinarily grateful, because this is one of the key issues in the polemic about Israel, and I think it was handled, for the most part, very, very well. I would like to add just a couple of points. That countries targeted for boycotts tend to be seen as both oppressive and relatively vulnerable, whereas countries that are massively powerful and relatively invulnerable are much less likely to be boycotted. Also, it is intriguing that both South Africa and Israel have been seen as peripheral Western states, viewed as part of the West, of the democratic order, and thus judged more stringently as a result. And I wonder if the same can be said for expectations underlying views of Western corporations, such as Nestle. Another possible answer to the why Israel query is that Israel-Palestine, and this might be a bit counterintuitive in our own era, but Israel-Palestine presents a conflict with an address. A notion that Israel, as a stable and powerful state, is responsible, a responsible party, and that it can affect change. And thus the focus in BDS is on Israel rather than many other states, which are also sites of nationalist, communitarian, or tribal aggression and claims to exclusive right. Israel is hardly the only country in the world where indigenous peoples are denied their inalienable rights, including the right to live on their land. But in most other countries of the world, that alienation process either happened long ago, or if it's happening in our own era, it's increasingly difficult to distinguish the virtuous from the complicit. Ironically, as chaos in the Arab world persists, as death tolls in Syria skyrocket, the BDS campaign may well enjoy increased support precisely for this reason, a little bit like the man who's lost his keys in the dark looking under the lamppost where they surely are not to be found, and yet only the lamppost offers light. Now, there is an unusual prominence in the BDS movement accorded to the academic boycott. And this is something we haven't really talked about separately and deserves attention, because it's quite unusual. Universities play a major role in the BDS campaign. They didn't play nearly as big a role in the South African anti-apartheid movement. There was an academic boycott component. We've talked about this. But it was much less significant. Now, one could argue, and I'm not saying this to be flip, that universities are to BDS what athletics were to the anti-apartheid movement. That universities in Israel have a kind of global reach because of the influence and the significance of Israeli academic knowledge on a global scale. And opponents of BDS are aware of this. And they point to essential Israeli medical and communications technology to justify the free flow of knowledge. If Stephen Hawking wants to boycott Israel, they say, you know, he should give back his wheelchair and so forth. So there's this kind of apologetic, I'm not making this argument, I'm simply reproducing it in order to, I hope, offer a slightly more sophisticated argument. It is precisely Israel's prominence in knowledge-rich industries that, for BDS supporters, would make its universities targets for boycott. And yet, the case of the discriminatory Oxford biologist aside, certainly in North America, in science and the professions, collaboration between Israeli and Western academics remains quite common. Also, between Israeli and Arab researchers, including Palestinian researchers, in the scientific and professional faculties of many North American universities. Israeli lectures tend to be boycotted at academic gatherings in the humanities. Now, what gain is there in keeping Israeli academics away from lecture halls in the United Kingdom? Will it pressure the Israeli government to change its ways? Will it raise public awareness that will lead to support for the transformation of Israel into a binational and fully democratic state, as the BDS movement seems to desire? I don't wish to disrespect my esteemed Israeli colleagues, and yet somehow I suspect that neither your government nor the Israeli public will be moved to end the occupation if Eyal Naveh or Scott Urey are disinvited from a conference at Cornell. The biggest losers in the academic boycott are rather the visitors' potential interlocutors. And yet the academic boycott has taken on an important role in the BDS movement, but perhaps to a counterproductive end, as shown in the recent failure of the BDS motion that was brought to the collected JCRs at the University of Oxford, and that was voted down by a 7-1 motion. I read the motion. The B aspect of it was extremely prominent. The DNS was there as well, with also, and this confirms Jeremy's comments, no concept of an end to where this, when the BDS resolution would be considered caduque, to cite the late Yasser Arafat. Now, to end on a historicist note, Tehila made a very important point earlier, that the anti-apartheid movement and BDS are quite different, to be sure, as are Israel and South Africa, but not in the apologetic way by which these differences are often drawn. Israel's a much stronger and more stable polity than South Africa during the last decades of apartheid. Israel is unlikely to be shunned by the diaspora in the way that, say, the Dutch Reformed Church was excluded from the World Union of Reformed Churches in 1981. Israel's startup entrepreneurs have not distanced themselves from the regime as did the globalizing white business elite of the 1970s and 80s. Israel is simply put, and supporters of BDS should be aware of this, a far more tenacious society. A legacy of the Holocaust, which I am not invoking instrumentally, but rather operationally, that the Holocaust does play an ongoing role in Israeli collective memory, that despite all of the country's vociferous tendencies, has a tremendous cohesive role, as does the legacy of Ben-Gurion's Mamlachtiyut, centralized statist nation building. The split in Israel between Ashkenazim and Mizrachim has indeed been serious, but it has never led to the sort of civil conflict as has happened in the 20th century between Afrikaners and British, from the Anglo-Boer Wars of the early century through only slightly less worrisome conflicts, really until after the Second World War. In Israel, a sense of both desperation and confidence militates against the loss of resolve that affected Afrikaners' elites during apartheid's last decades. And I must mention as well the relations between the South African governing elite and the ANC in the 1980s and 1990s, which took a different form from relations between Israel and the PLO and the PA in the 1990s and the noughts. So if we are to think historically, which I favor, we will see substantial differences between these two situations, and we will think about substantial differences between how the situations of South Africa and Israel-Palestine are best addressed. My argument that in its current form, BDS is unlikely to affect substantive political change, directly or indirectly, does not mean that I don't think the movement's support will spread. As I've said, it might indeed grow, not only because of injustices perpetrated in the occupied territories, but because of technological change, which facilitates virtual political activity, despair over the possibility of change elsewhere in the Middle East. The visibility of the Holy Land in Christian and Muslim consciousness, and then, as we just heard in last talk, we just heard the demographic changes in Western Europe and North America and how they affect the Christian churches. And here's my final point. The visibility of Palestine in Christian consciousness, as opposed to, say, other troubled lands, reflects a kind of localism, which gets us back to the local nature of the boycott movements in the 19th and earlier 20th centuries. It is a kind of localism, an unselfconscious continuation of the direct association between terra sancta and nascent European national consciousness that was noted more than half a century ago by the great intellectual historian Ernst Kantorowicz. BDS is a prominent manifestation of citizen activism in the modern world. But it is equally so a sign of the unceasing gaze of much of humanity upon one particular space and the peoples who dwell in strife within it. Thank you.